Welcome into the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. I want you guys to imagine something real quick. I want you to imagine inner city America where the gang problem is solved not just by the police, but solved by everyday citizens working within a charitable organization. And a structure where you and I, lawyers, barristers, everyday citizens can get together, team up with the police. We can work as one organization, get together and solve inner city crime, guns, everything, and work together and get the murder rate, the crime rate, drugs, everything off the streets and make everything safer. I know you may be saying, Tim, it's La La Land. It'll never happen. What if I told you that my guest today not only has found that solution, that it's been brought up to the city of Chicago, but that it happened, and it happened in the country of Honduras. My guest today, Ross Halperin, has a brand new book out there, and he's studied this for decades. And this book is fantastic, folks. The name of the book is Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. And when you read this book, it's going to curl your hair how much violence was in this land, how much corruption was in this land, not just by drug lords, not just by criminals, but by the actual establishment, by security companies, by everyone, and how much this one charitable organization had to try to overcome in order to work with the people, the poor, the regular citizens of Honduras to try to take back their land. Let me tell you a little bit about Ross, and then we'll bring him in. Ross Halperin is a man who has dedicated himself to this very issue. Ross attended Harvard University, worked on Wall Street, and a campaign to reconstruct the library in his hometown. We'll talk about that real quick before we get to the actual issue at hand. He worked under Mark A.R. Kleiman, one of the world's leading criminal justice scholars. He started reporting Bear Witness, this book, in 2018 and has spent much of his time in Honduras. Let's welcome him in to the first time to True Crime Tuesday. Ross, welcome in.
Thanks, Tim. It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you here, sir. Let's talk a little bit about the library first. I wanted to try to have you here before the library was dedicated. Tell us a little bit about your father and the library that was dedicated to him.
Wow. Well, thanks for asking about that. I grew up in a town in suburban New York, and it was also the town where my father grew up. And he loved the town so much that he like made a point of raising me and my brothers there. He specifically wanted to live in that town. And, you know, when he grew up, he worked like every odd job there was, the gas station, the local taxi company, you know, busing at different places. So he just kind of knew everyone and was super plugged into the town. And he died in 2008. It was a very sudden and tragic thing. But when that happened, they renamed the downtown library after him. And it's really cool. It's, you know, right in the center of town, across from the train station, right next to the main strip. So it's an important building in town, but it was in like disrepair. Super old building, not arranged in a nice way. So we, at that point, started a campaign to revitalize it. And, you know, it took 7 years, which is about how long this book took me. But we ended up raising about $4 million and doing a total gut renovation of the building. And it's just an awesome place. Tons of kids programs, author events, ESL classes, everything you'd possibly want out of a library. So it was really special to do my book launch there, which happened last Tuesday.
So you brought Bear Witness there to launch it. And I got to ask you, just between us and, I don't know, quite a few thousand friends, how did it feel to bring this baby that you bore to the world to a library named after your father?
It was really special. I mean, look, I think, you know, libraries are like, not to be too melodramatic about it, but they're these temples to books. And that was like kind of the spirit with which we built it, rebuilt it. And, I didn't imagine I was myself going to be writing one pretty soon thereafter, but maybe in some subconscious way, it did lead to that. So, yeah, it was super special. And the other cool thing was just like a lot of friends or parents of friends who maybe I played soccer with when I was a little kid, or people who worked with my dad, like in the 80s, showed up. And it just felt like this very cool moment. And yeah, it was a very special night.
That's awesome. That's quite awesome.
Yeah.
This book that you've put together, Ross, let me tell you, most there's, I think in America, we like to put the blinders on, right? We like to think that we're the most important thing in the world. We should really be focused on our own backyards. Why would we even want to peer into South America? And it's just always been corrupt. We don't need to look at it. Why would we even bother? It's just always going to be that way. Why would we even want to take a second look? It's never going to change. But it really is important to look at some of these case studies to see why it is the way it is. Because in our own backyard, we're seeing things change, not for the better, but for the worse. And there are case studies in other countries where we can learn from and take from some of the things that are happening there. And you've pulled up one of the best examples.
Yeah.
Tell me how it is that you came across this case in Honduras, and what it is that's going on there that's so important that can be brought right to our own backyard and can change what we're doing.
Sure. So, when I came across this story, I was working with a guy named David Kennedy, who is a criminologist at John Jay. And, he's not just a professor. He's not just a writer, an excellent writer who wrote a book called Don't Shoot. But he's also someone who actually knows how to go into some of the most violent neighborhoods in this country and work with police and prosecutors and the community to drastically reduce the amount of gun violence. And he's been doing that for decades. I highly recommend that your listeners check out his work.
Okay.
But at that time, he had read a book called Ghetto Side, which is another fantastic book. And it's all about the problem of impunity in the United States. So many people probably don't realize this, but whereas in other wealthy, advanced democracies in like Europe and Asia, well over 90% of homicides are solved. In the United States, that number is much lower. So at the time we were researching, it was probably maybe two-thirds were solved. Now that's gone down. I think it's closer to 50%.
Wow.
And the significant majority of shootings are actually non-fatal. And the solve rate on those is even more disturbingly low. So this was the problem that we were taking a look at and asking what can be done about it? Why is it this way? How can we fix it? And Kennedy organized a sort of summit, symposium, whatever you want to call it, in New York City with 20 experts on homicide to discuss this. So the New York City chief of detectives was there, someone from the Detroit department was there, a bunch of academics who had the relevant expertises were there. And Kurt Verbeek, the guy who ended up being the subject of my book, was supposed to be there, but because of some turmoil happening in Honduras at the time, which is something I describe toward the end of the book, he couldn't leave. So he video conferenced in and he gave this, 15-minute PowerPoint presentation about what they had done to solve the problem we were looking at, impunity, and not just solve it anywhere, but solve it in one of the poorest, most dangerous, most lawless places in the hemisphere. So an even more extreme environment than, say, certain parts of Chicago. So I was really fascinated in this concept that they had tried. And then also, I was also just interested in this guy and what he had done and who he was as a man. And that's where this project started. So pretty soon after that, I shot him an email and I said, "Hey, can I write a magazine article about you?" And he said, "Sure." And a month later, I was in Honduras.
Wow. And you're off and running. And it's not just, can I write a magazine article about you? Now all of a sudden it's you're in deep, and you're
Yeah.
in the culture, and And boy, when you're in the culture, you're in the middle of it in Honduras. It really is a culture of, is it safe to say a culture of corruption at the time that you're in it, or is it more you're hearing the stories of corruption and it's much better than what it was?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, the day-to-day down there's so many great people, and most people are trying to do the right thing down there. But yeah, I mean, there's no point in not just coming out and saying it. I mean, this is a country which has had, one of the highest homicide rates in the world for a long time. It has an incredibly corrupt government. It has an incredibly ineffectual government. And, they're also just hamstrung by poverty. So even to the extent that there are cops and prosecutors and judges who want to do a good job, which there are, of course, many of those, it's hard because they're working in desks. Sorry, they're working in offices that might not have desks, or their printers might not have any ink, or the cops might want to go and arrest someone, but the entire police force in a city of 1 million people might have 20 vehicles. And half of them might not even have gas. So there's so many factors working against the administration of justice there, which I think makes it all the more remarkable that the two subjects of my book not only tried to do something about justice, but actually succeeded to a pretty impressive extent.
Yeah, to kind of piggyback on what you're saying there, Ross, there's a just a snippet from the book where you talk about things that kind of snowball, right? Things that kind of snowball out of control. You talk about the instance of a dam, building a dam to acquire energy, right? And you probably can expound on this better than I can, but it's just the idea of, we're working with archaic means in order to acquire electricity to feed Honduras. So it's diesel or gas or burning wood or coal or whatever it is, fossil fuels in order to keep Honduras going. So European means, okay, we'll build a dam. Well, you don't really have the water supply to keep the dam going, but that didn't matter because there's contracts to be had, right? I guess you could kind of take it from there and explain why it failed so horribly.
Yeah, like I said, so I think, there's this long history of the American government, the UN, these agencies going to countries like Honduras and trying to quote unquote fix them. And, this is done with good intentions, but it's often being done by people who are not on the ground there. And they may have these ivory tower theories or concepts, but, and I think, I'll circle back to your question in a second, but the two subjects in my book, these are people who one is an American, one is a Honduran, and their whole philosophy is like, before endeavoring to help the poor, you have to live like the poor, with the poor for an extended period of time and really understand what they need, what is the situation on the ground. So, what you're referring to is the story of this dam, which is sort of, I don't know, maybe a metaphor you could call it, for the misguidedness of certain approaches. But this was in the 70s. At the time, Honduras was, a significant chunk of the population didn't have access to electricity. They were reliant on burning like charcoal and wood for power. So the military officials running the country, it was a dictatorship at the time, and foreign aid agencies decide we are going to build one of the largest dams in the world in Honduras. And the country is going to saddle itself with a huge amount of debt to build this marvel of engineering. And it's ambitious, it's done with the right intentions. But as you know, it ends up sort of being a comedy of errors, and that almost plunged this entire nation into darkness. And there's, I don't want to give too much away of, because I think it's sort of a fun and dramatic story, but there's the European attempts to fix the problem as the dam is leaking, as the turbines are at risk of being overwhelmed, as people all across the country are dealing with, 6-hour power outages. And then at the last minute, some Honduran engineers jump in and sort of give it a go, Honduran style. Yeah, but all in all, I think it's really the reason I included that story, beyond the fact that I just think it's fascinating and sort of have this weird fascination with dams, if I'm being honest, is it's just contrast with the Kurt and Carlos, the subjects of my book, their approach to doing things, which is very much, I think the traditional approach is more top down. Some, person from Washington or Switzerland comes in and says, this is the way to do things. These guys were a bottoms up approach. Let's go there and figure out what's needed and build from there.
Right. So Kurt and Carlos, when they first start to build this organization in Honduras, they had to start with a foundation. Where do they start with this foundation to begin to build up Honduras? I mean, you would think the first place they have to attack is somewhere on the streets, but they really begin with, isn't it with education? Isn't that where they begin? Isn't it literacy? Isn't that the first place they start?
Yeah, so like I would say for the first half of their adulthood, they're doing the conventional things that people do to help the poor. They're doing it to a very extreme degree, to a very commendable degree, to a degree that I think would impress anyone. For example, as you know, one of the first really radical decisions that they make is they're both in Honduras doing charity work, and they say, we are now voluntarily going to move with our wives and our kids to one of the poorest and most dangerous and most gang-ridden neighborhoods in the entire country, which is a place most Hondurans would never even set foot in. So they move there, and as you say, they're doing the typical things that people do to help the poor. Carlos builds a school, he's running a microlender, he's has a health clinic. Kurt is improving the water system. He's helping with land titling. And it's all the things that missionaries, humanitarians do to an extreme. But they get to a point, and this is really where the book starts, and I think gets quite their story gets quite dramatic and fascinating, is they say, look, that can only help people so much when they live in a lawless place, like our neighborhood. Because there is a gang, at that point, it was a gang called the Puchos, who is extorting people. So, okay, you got a business off the ground. We gave you a loan. It's going well. It's working. The gang member is going to show up and say, give me half of your earnings every week, or I'll kill you. This gang was murdering people, raping people. This gang was just scaring people to the extent where people didn't even feel comfortable walking on the streets. There were girls who wouldn't go to school anymore because their parents wouldn't allow them to make the 5-minute walk there. So their point was, when violence and impunity reign, none of that other stuff really matters much. So we are going to do something radical. We are going to do something that do-gooders rarely do, that the government is supposed to be doing, but in Honduras does not. We are going to take on crime directly, not indirectly by mentoring young men. We are going to take on crime by taking on crime.
Which, I mean, is more than admirable, right? I mean, you say, okay, well, that's great. You're going to take on crime, but who are you, right? Who are you to say you're going to come in from the outside and tackle a system that's been going on for as long as time has been going on, right? I mean, not just Honduras, Italy. Who you can name multiple countries that have worked with mafioso or organized crime has happened all over the world. It's as old as time is gone, right?
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is a great point. Is like, well, pretty much everyone agrees that one of the things the government should definitely be doing is solving murders.
Yeah.
And we think of that as an exclusively governmental function. But one of the things these guys realize from being in the thick of things for so long is if you take a step back and really think about it, the most important thing, the aspect of reducing crime is really solving homicides and punishing murderers. And in popular culture, that's often portrayed as the ingenious detective finding some clue, or the crusading prosecutor making some brilliant argument, or the CSI person finding some trace of hair. But the reality is, for most homicide, actually the vast majority of homicide cases get solved in a much more simple way. There's a witness who knows what happened, and They're either willing to testify or not. So if you think about that, you don't need a badge to find a witness. You don't need a badge to convince that witness to testify. You don't need a badge to protect that witness, which in Honduras is an additional factor because there's a risk of retaliation. So they said, we can do all that. Then they said, okay, we can't legally go out and arrest these gang members, but the actual act of doing that wasn't the holdup in Honduras. The holdup was that the police didn't know what the gang members' names were. They didn't know where they lived. So this charity could do that. You can figure out what's his name, where does he live, where is he going to be at, 8 p.m. on Tuesday. And the cops didn't have cars, so they could say, okay, I can't click on the handcuffs, but I could rent a car, pick up three cops, and drive them to where the guy is going to be. And then the next phase of things, without getting into too much detail, yeah, sure, the prosecutor has to be the one arguing in court and the judge has to make the actual rulings. But this was a very weak system. And it turned out that the charity's lawyer was able to be very involved in that process and really help the prosecutors work on the cases, develop the arguments. And as I said, really the most important thing in all of this is the witness. And that's where the focus was. Find, convince, protect. And that was the key.
There's an interesting question here, and I tell you what, Ross, we'll take our break early here. Because I want to ask you a very important question. I'm going to ask it and I want you to hold on to it until we get to the other side of the break. And that's this. I understand that in a third world country, you can kind of get away with aiding a weaker police department with doing this. And I understand maybe even in some inner cities here in America, maybe you could get away with kind of aiding in that way. But here in America, you have some very staunch, let's say, anti-advocates that would say, where's the line here where you say, isn't that vigilante justice? If I jump in and try to assume the role of a officer of the court when I don't have the authority to do so, where is that line drawn of vigilante justice? So I want to ask you, when we come back, at any time, did this group overstep their bounds? Okay, so when we come back, we'll answer that question. The book, boy, folks, I tell you, is an enthralling one, and I do encourage you to get a copy of it. We have a link in the description of this program. It's called Bear Witness: The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. Ross Halperin is our guest. When we come back, we'll ask the question, not only did they overstep their bounds, but can we institute this in America? It's a great idea to take a system like this and put it in New York, Chicago, LA, and try to defeat some of the gang violence, get rid of some of the drugs in our inner cities, and really get our community involved again and get some of the crime out of our cities. When we come back, more with Ross Halperin right here on the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-pack battery kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. My guest is Ross Halperin. The name of the book, Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. Okay, so Ross, before the break, we were talking about the scenario of what Kurt and Carlos were doing with their group in Honduras. And that is assisting the police and the courts where they were weak. You know, being able to take three policemen in a rental car to where these suspects would be, giving them the name of some of these gang members, helping with lawyers in courts, helping prosecutors with certain things, maybe with briefs or whatever they need in order to get some of these, whether it be gang members or suspects or whoever it is, prosecuted through the system and getting them where they need to be in jails, right? Here's the question I left you with. At what point, and especially here in America, if we try to institute the system in America where charities are helping or charitable organizations are helping, at what point are we crossing that line here in America? Because you know there's some, I want to call them anti-advocates, where they say, wait a minute, this isn't an officer of the court. This isn't somebody who's appointed. This isn't somebody who works for our system. At what point is this vigilante justice? At any time, did Kurt and Carlos's organization cross that line and become a vigilante?
Yeah, I mean, so this is what I think makes the story interesting, is that as soon as you wade into this world, you're now in these morally gray, you're in these gray realms where you're making compromises relative to what your ideals are. I actually have one helpful piece of context before I answer your question directly.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that like in a place like Honduras, there is, when you have as much crime and impunity as there is a lot of vigilantism, and not the type of sort of quasi pseudo vigilantism we've been talking about, mm-hmm. but covert detachments of police officers who go into neighborhoods and execute suspected gang members. Members of the community who take up arms and, you know, maybe protect their block, or other ones who take it a step further and hunt down members of the gang and murder them. So that happens a lot. And I think that this program was in some ways a reaction to that. Kurt and Carlos, first of all, I should say, a lot of people in Honduras do support that kind of stuff because they say, what else are we going to do? The police aren't doing anything. That's the only option. And Kurt and Carlos said, no, we don't approve of that. That is wrong. That is evil. We're going to try to find something in the middle. But you're 100% right. I mean, you are empowering unelected officials to help solve cases and crimes. And you know, I think that there are, in theory, protections against abuse. There's obviously a trial that happens and evidence that has to be presented. But, you know, one thing that happens in the book, and this won't surprise anyone, is when witnesses are convinced to start stepping up and testifying against a gang, people get hurt. Mm-hmm. So if I'm some charity, I'm not a sworn in cop, and I just convinced a witness to testify against the gang member, and that witness gets hurt, have I done something inappropriate? Have I crossed a line I shouldn't have? Or was that just something that needed to have, this is a risk that people need to take in order for the neighborhood to be safe? And I think, you know, these ethical questions aren't just abstract. There are people even within the charity ASJ are in Kurt and Carlos's orbit who question the program. They say, we do think this is not something that Christian humanitarians should be doing. And part of that is maybe the risk of retaliation, but it's also working with the police, because the police down there, I mean, the police force down there is corrupt and yeah. doing bad stuff and stealing jewelry from homes when they go inside of it. And, you know, when they're making arrests, it's very normal for the Honduran cops to just give a suspect a beating after they're already handcuffed. Mm-hmm. So is it appropriate to be working with a police force that's doing stuff like that? And I think they find themselves sort of caught in a bit of a bind, because the program starts to work and the gang members start getting arrested and they're feeling that the neighborhood is getting better, but they're having to make these compromises. And one of the things I admire about them, at the very least, is that they always wrestle with these things with their eyes open. They're not the type of people who say, no, we're everything we're doing is perfect and great and fine, and all these people criticizing us are fools. They say, no, like, I hear you, but here's why we think we have to keep moving forward, all things considered.
You bring up something with ASJ that was a little bit of a double-edged sword, in that they did have to work with the police, but the police were corrupt, right? It was one of those things where they had to make that delicate balance, right? I, you know, the devil I know versus the devil I don't, and they got into muddy waters throughout their journey. You didn't know who the players were. It seems like every time you turn around, there's a new enemy, right? And whereas I think here in America, is it safe to say that the lines are a little more clear, or are they not? Are we dealing with a society these days where our society is getting more gray, and maybe it is time for an organization like ASJ?
Look, I think that, look, Tegucigalpa, Nueva Suyapa, the community I write about in 2005, is a very extreme place in terms of violence, in terms of impunity, in terms of police corruption, in terms of poverty. But I think people would be surprised at the extent to which places like the South Side of Chicago have dynamics that are quite similar. You know, I'm going to butcher the statistics. I'm doing it off the top of my head, sure. But the Chicago Sun-Times came out with a report somewhat recently looking at the percentage of murders that were solved in Chicago since like 2018. And the number was alarmingly low. It was like, I don't know, 25% or something.
Yikes.
And the fundamental issue is the same. It's all about witnesses. And there's this gap in trust between the community and law enforcement. And the witnesses there are also scared of retaliation, because there are scary people there who shoot other people. And then also, they have a lack of trust in the police and prosecutors who they need to work with in order to participate in a trial. So the dynamic's the same, and the solution is probably the same. It's about figuring out how you can bridge this crevasse between witnesses and law enforcement. And look, there are some differences, of course, important ones, but I do think we need to come up with creative ideas for accomplishing that. And the results might be extraordinary, and it might be more solvable than it seems.
There's another dynamic, I think, though, here in play that I didn't see in Bear Witness. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Ross, and that's this. I think in inner city communities in the U.S. versus maybe Honduras, there is a second and maybe even a third thing at play here. And let me play this out, and then I'll throw to your expertise. There's this criminal self-policing that goes on at times. So you may not be able to, in the inner city, you may say, like, snitches get stitches, right? So you know, someone's going to come forward and maybe try to report somebody for doing crimes. Well, no. I can go to the local mafioso, or I can go to the local drug lord who may be overseeing his people or taking care of his people, so to speak, and go, listen, or the humanitarian drug lord, I'm using air quotes if you're watching the video, I know it's an oxymoron, and say, hey, you know, even though you're damaging my community, I know that, you know, there's a kiddie rapist out here that's doing harm to all the children in the community, and say, we go take care of this guy because the cops won't take care of him. And that guy's got his finger on the pulse of the community. He'll go take that guy out. And he'll do it faster than the cops. I don't know if that exists in Honduras or not. Is that element there?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the most fascinating twists in this story, I guess I'm giving something away here, but that's okay, is there's this gang and they're terrorizing the neighborhood. It's mostly teenage boys and very young men who are, you know, terrorizing 50,000 people. And as Peace and Justice, which is the name of Kurt and Carlos's program, is getting going and starting to have some success, as you say, there's a parallel thing happening, a parallel solution to crime. And it's a guy who's from the neighborhood, who was in the military, whose father was essentially bludgeoned by these kids because the father was a security guard, so he had a gun. And one of the things this gang was very systematic about was confiscating guns from people in the neighborhood. So after they beat the crap out of this guy's father, he goes, fuck it, I'm just going to start taking these kids out. And he starts murdering them one by one. And it becomes pretty clear that this is not just a person who's sort of against the ropes and defending himself and his community. This is a person who seems to enjoy murdering teenage boys. And he does it with gusto. He does it with style. He does it almost to showcase his cruelty. And the remarkable thing is people in the community adore him. A lot of people say, look, this guy is a hero, because what Kurt and Carlos are doing is totally clandestine. It's secret. And they're seeing the gang weaken and weaken and weaken. And they're seeing this guy kill gang members. Something pretty admirable about Kurt and Carlos in this program, I think, is they say, look, this guy is technically an enemy of our enemy, but we do not approve of this. This guy is as bad as the gang members, if not worse. So he becomes, as you say, sort of the second enemy that they try to take down. And it's very complicated. I mean, speaking about witness intimidation in the case of the gang, it was a little bit abstract. Whereas in the case of this vigilante, I mean, he was literally, he would murder someone and then he would show up at their wake or burial with an assault rifle and tell everyone there, if you testify against me, I will kill you. He wasn't even above stuff like that. So I think you're right. This is stuff that happens in all of these neighborhoods. And whether it's gangs or vigilantes, there's always an element of, oh, we're just protecting the neighborhood and we're going to step in where the police won't.
Do you think, as far as, I want to compare and contrast again between Honduras and America, do you think that there would be receptibility here in America to, as far as police departments go, to setting up like ASJ or a Guardian Angels type program where you would have an organization like this that would come in each city, each inner city, and set up an organization like this?
It's a fascinating question. I would love to know the answer to that. I mean, you obviously don't need permission to start finding witnesses to a crime. I mean, it's funny because in the true crime community, I do think there has been this rise in, you know, these very serial killer cases or cold cases, people stepping up on the internet to try to solve them. But you don't see people doing that as much for like ordinary course gun crime in cities. And Do I think so anyone, I guess, in theory, could start doing that, as long as they don't break laws like harass people or arrest people, or intimidate people. But I think one of the secret sauces to the success of this program was they hired a private eye who was a former soldier, but really someone who had a sort of cops mentality, a cops approach. And he was able to convince senior members of the police force to work with him. And I think that was a matter of recruiting the right person. And these cops were happy. You know, it was an open question. Like, were they going to want the help, or were they going to feel like someone was stepping on their turf? And it turned out that because he was a person with the right background and personality, and because he was bringing witnesses and evidence and intelligence to them, a number of them were very happy to work with them. And it's not just the cops, it was the prosecutors too. Because I'll just add one more thing to that. I think, you know, people think of these countries and they go, oh my God, all the corrupt cops and terrible prosecutors. But Kurt and Carlos said, no, like, we believe that there's good ones in the criminal justice system, and we just need to find them. And they do want to do the right thing. They do want to solve crimes. They just don't have the resources. And so they were able to find people who they could work with.
Because here's my thought. An organization like this would be a perfect place for someone who's a retired prosecutor or retired cop, if they want a place to land after they've retired, to come in and help, right? A place for them if they're kind of itchy, getting the kind of the itch to want to be in, but not all the way in, to you know, not put themselves in the danger of fire, but at the same time be helping out and wanting to solve cases. It's kind of the perfect stopgap, right?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's the idea here. And I think, you know, the magic, yeah, they have to have skills on the other side too, right?
Yes. Yeah.
These have to be people who can connect with, you know, a woman who just lost her husband and is terrified and doesn't trust the police. So you have to be someone who could sit down with that woman, gain her confidence, hear her out, work with her over months or years to participate in this process. And I think one of the most fascinating turns in this story is, eventually, Kurt and Carlos come to realize that this whole witness protection thing, it's not just a matter of keeping them safe from retaliation. It's also a matter of their psychological and emotional well-being, because they have to maintain their resolve and, frankly, sanity over a period of months or years when a dangerous gang member's Achilles heel is essentially their mouth. And that's a very trying and brutal experience for people, especially when you maybe just lost your family member. You maybe just lost the one stream of income that was sustaining your family. So they do something, I think, that's quite unusual, which is they add a psychologist to the trio. So the program becomes a triumvirate of a private eye, a lawyer, and a psychologist. And the psychologist does, you know, provide formal therapy to witnesses or informants who want it. But more importantly, she was just an ear and a person who could make people feel all right. And that triumvirate ended up being the combination that worked. And once the program was more systematized and expanded to a bunch of other neighborhoods, that just became how they did it.
I think it's brilliant. I mean, you know, you almost have to have that, because the one thing you do when you first get a witness is you have to sequester them, right? And you have to put them on an island. When you put them on that island, your mind starts playing tricks on you, because you were part of an organization at one time, or you were part of a community that you knew, you know, whether you were a witness to something or whether you were part of a criminal community and you're flipping on them. You were part of something, and now you're sequestered from it, and now you're not sure of yourself, and thoughts start running. So you need to get them out one way or another. And if you can't expel them to somebody who's trained to help you sort through them, well, then you start having doubts. And who are these people who are telling you, well, you know, you need to get them out in a court of law, right?
Yeah, I mean, Tim, you are getting at one of the most powerful things here. Think about it. I mean, in Honduras, these were anonymous witnesses. So they were testifying under cloaks. And these people can't talk about, they already can't even tell their own families, their close friends. They have no one to talk about. It's totally a secret. You know, the private eye or the psychologist, they're storing them in their phone with fake names. So they needed an outlet to speak, to share. And, you know, I think it's not just the fear of retaliation. It's also the grief of losing, of loss, you know, of a relative or someone you knew. And then it's also like, these people are heroes. Mm-hmm. Like, these are the people who are putting everything on their back in return for no compensation, no glory. It's all risk to try to make their community a better place. And there's not going to be a statue erected to them. There's not going to be a fair where they're brought on stage. And I think in some way this book is like an homage to witnesses, because, you know, in the popular culture of crime solving, it's the superhero, it's the cop, it's the prosecutor who's the hero. But I would argue that in reality, it's often these unheralded everyday people who, against all odds, when you think there is no way anyone would ever testify against a serial killer, they say, you know what? I'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which brings me to my next point/question. That's this, Ross. You know, in every tragedy, we say we want to remember the victims. We want to keep the victims' names out there. Although we do a really horrible job of doing that, I think. We really do a horrible job of doing that. And in the book, you use the term martyr, quite a bit, and you keep that term out there. And I'll let you explain why you do that. But why, and this is my question to you, why is it that we can't elevate people more that do give their lives in the name of trying to get rid of the evil element? Why can't we elevate them more and suppress the evil name less? Because it seems like evil gets this huge spotlight and martyrs don't. And we can't reverse that for some reason. It seems like evil gets this huge spotlight and the people who put their lives on the line, they get suppressed and we forget.
Man, that's such a profound question. And I mean, you, as someone who's seen so many of these stories and cases, you might be better equipped to answer it than I would. But maybe it sort of taps into something I just said, which is like, heroism might be more mundane in reality than we think. And, you know, solving crime may not be, you know, Bruce Wayne putting on some crazy outfit and doing all these things. It might just be like some ordinary average Joe who you never hear about, who shows up at a trial, sits in the witness box for 12 minutes and answers some questions. Maybe that's just not as immediately fascinating, but I hope people who read this book are drawn to those folks. And I think that I think they're fascinating. I mean, I want to be careful, like, not to reveal too much, but I remember just like, there was an interview I had with like a guy who, you know, was working probably, you know, one of the lowest rung jobs you could possibly work in, and even in Nueva Suyapa. And we were talking about something else. And then just for some reason out of the blue, he revealed to me that he was a witness in a very heavy case. And I just remember like being so blown away by this person. Like, why did you do that, man? Like, no one, I don't know that I would do that. I don't know that, you know, 99 out of 100 people would do that. So, yeah, I think those people should be celebrated even when they're anonymous and I can't say their names for their safety.
Sure. And you shouldn't, right? I mean, the idea is to keep them safe first and foremost above all else. And that's kind of the, that's kind of the horrible thing out of this, right? They took such a chance. They should be celebrated. But at the same time, it puts them in the firing line, right? It puts them in danger.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, as you know, in the second part of the book, in the first part of the book, you see these two characters pushing bravery to a really extreme level. And to some extent, like getting away with it in the sense that they and their families and their staff didn't get hurt. And they almost preach this gospel of courage to their staff and to the people they're working with. Hey, step up and go in this neighborhood and do this work. Hey, witness, step up and testify. But in the second part of the book, you see the downside of that because they take on another enemy who, once again, is the type of opponent that no one in Honduras would ever touch, but these guys decide we are going to take this force on. And one of their employees gets murdered, assassinated. And that really changes things for them. They say, we have to get security. We have to protect ourselves. We have to be more careful. We are responsible for these people's lives. And, there's a lot of things to say on that. But one thing I will say is from then on out, the organization and the leadership of it has security guards with them almost everywhere they go.
And you hate to chalk it up to a learning experience, but that's a hell of a learning experience when you're finally touched in that way, right? I mean, it's not the exuberance of youth. These aren't young guys that are learning this experience. This is a little bit of, I don't want to say innocence to evil, but evil knows no bounds, right? It'll go wherever it chooses to go in order to get its goals met. And sometimes when you're on the side of good, you try to take the path of right and don't realize that, like I said, evil has no bounds.
Yeah, one of Kurt and Carlos's core values has always been extreme optimism and focusing on the positive, the good. How can what we're doing help poor people? And they have a habit, I would say, of not ignoring risk, but significantly minimizing it. And there's good parts about that, but there's also costs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ross, I tell you, this book, I think, will change a lot of outlooks as to how people think about how we can combat crime here in America. I know after I've been reading it, I've been thinking about how we can change how we do things here, right? How we can look after our own communities. I really think that right now our own communities here are fractured, right? We're very much fractured. And I think if we take a look around, it doesn't take much to fix things. It really doesn't. It's just being a little more hypervigilant, right? And doing just a little bit more to fix what it is that what we're doing.
Part of the message, I think, of these guys and probably of the book is like these problems that seem so insurmountable, especially related to crime, might be more solvable than we think.
Yeah.
I know that's a message that they hope well, people would take away from this.
Yeah. So I highly encourage people to read this book, Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. Ross Halperin is the author of this book. We have a link in the description of the program so you can go get the book and read it for yourself. Again, folks, this isn't just a local problem to Honduras. It's a worldwide problem that, again, it fits a perfect solution to the city you're living in, to the inner cities that are in our country, that we can just plug and play, put it right into every city in America and clean up the problems that we're having with drugs, with gangs, with the gun issues, with everything that we have going on right now. We can clean it up here in America and get it done. There's no reason why we can't help as a community, our law enforcement, get things cleaned up. There just isn't a reason why we can't do it. So, Ross, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you. Folks, I want to tell you today, no dumb crime, stupid criminals because of the holiday weekend. We gave Jess the weekend off. I want to remind you of a couple things before we let you go today. One, the Darkness Radio Apple app is up and available and updated. Go get it at the Apple Store right now. Two, darknessradioshow.com. Go visit the store there. Support the show. Three, the executive producer of True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio is Troy Palmer. Thank you so much for everything you do. And four, if you're not watching this show on video, maybe you're just listening to the audio podcast, go check out the original Darkness Radio on YouTube and see my face and Ross's face, his beautiful shining face right now. Go to the YouTube channel and like and subscribe if you've enjoyed today's program. That'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening and watching the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.